Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/decide. That's linkedin.com/decide. Terms and conditions apply.
It's Mike Shope.
I have these notes, but I gotta say, I'm just fired up to be here today.
And the Bulldog.
Pretty cool! Pretty damn cool!
On WGR.
Come on! Get up! Come on, get up! If you're as psyched as I am!
Sports Radio 550.
Let me give you one draft prop underdog that I like a little bit, at least. I want to just talk about it, and then maybe you, Joe, or our guest, Ryan, will want to talk me out of it. Is Jalen Waddle to be the first receiver picked nuts at plus 650? Like, there, I'm gullible, and there was hype about him, like, yesterday. So, I admit it. Ryan McChrystal from Number Fire. I don't think you know me, Ryan, but I'm just telling you also, since you're new in our conversation. I am gullible. So, you tell me. Is it nuts to think that Waddle could be picked before Ja'Marr Chase, in your opinion?
Well, it's not a bet that I would place, but I don't think you're nuts. The wide receiver props are one of the ones that I like placing because, you know, it only takes one team, and teams have such different views of all the different types of wide receivers that they want.
Mm-hmm.
So, there's almost never a consensus on the number one overall. So even though we keep hearing about Ja'Marr Chase as the favorite to go number one overall among the receivers, there's definitely teams that have Waddle first. So if the wide receivers start to slide, like if Chase doesn't go as high as the Bengals at number five, like he's being mentioned a lot, and they start to go further down, like could it, you know, if they're all on the board, maybe the Giants pick, could they take Waddle? Yeah, I think that sounds realistic.
Okay, yeah. I mean, the Bengals would be the scary one in this, right? Like if they're, apart from the point about Burrow and the Bengals, like, there could be a trade there. I've got quarterback needy teams that move up. And then what you said, then, well, you have teams who have different preferences. Do you think it like Chase is the prohibitive favorite here at the receiver position, Ryan, but do you think the fact that he didn't play last year, I guess it doesn't hurt him too badly in terms of the odds here. People think he'll still be the first receiver chosen. I just thought maybe there'd be more skepticism about the guys who sat out.
Yeah, I think it's just so hard to know. I think different teams probably all have slightly different views on that. And I think it would hurt a player like that a lot more if he were like the only one in this class who had just missed a year.
Mm-hmm.
But since there's a bunch of guys, especially a bunch of guys near the top that are all in the same boat, my sense is that most teams are just kind of trying to block that out and just, you know, treat everybody the same this year.
Ryan McChrystal, our guest here on WGR. I'm Mike Shope along with Sneaky Joe. Bulldog is off this week, the rest of this week. Well, Ryan, what kind of year are you having in terms of forecasting all this? My interest in doing that is only within the last few years. For a lot of years, I fought against it, but now I've sort of come to embrace it, and this year I just happen to love it. All the quarterback intrigue, even with the Bills, like not a player in any of that. And they have been a player many other times in that conversation. What's the year been like for you?
This is my favorite kind of year when you have a bunch of quarterbacks near the top because, you know, everybody wants to talk about it and just increases the intrigue. In the years where, you know, sometimes we'll have a year where we only got one quarterback, we know he's going to go number one, and then it's kind of a jumbled mess beyond that. It's hard to predict. But with the quarterbacks probably going 1, 2, 3, and maybe going 4, I mean, those debates are just like kind of just endless fun. You know, you can never really nobody can really ever come to an agreement on how to rank these guys, and you have so many quarterbacks near the top. So these are my favorite years to talk about the draft.
Yeah, and there's different conversations running concurrently. You know, you have who the prospects are. They have conversations about fits, you know, which teams are the best fits for each player. And then the one that I think I like the most is trying to read through and read between the lines in the different tweets and the different reports about what teams want to do. And no team is more interesting for this right now than San Francisco with that third pick, right? Like, just I told our Sal Capaccio, who was on with me a short time ago, my Twitter is every day, it's Twitter going, the 49ers aren't serious about Mac Jones, are they? Like, is that how you feel, or is that how people that you interact with seem to feel?
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, that's another thing that's made this draft so much fun is the intrigue with San Francisco, because when they first moved up, I think some people threw Mac Jones' name out there just because Shanahan had coached a lot of, like, the, you know, smart, savvy pocket passers like Matt Ryan and Garoppolo to a lesser extent. And so Mac Jones fits that, obviously. But I think most of us assumed, well, he's obviously going up for Justin Fields, right? Because he was sort of the consensus, you know, number three on the board after Lawrence and Wilson are gone. And so I think a lot of people, myself included, are just kind of stuck right now because Fields still, you know, I haven't changed my mind in thinking that Fields should be the pick there. But it's not like I think Mac Jones is bad. I think he's a deserved, you know, in the top 10 conversation. And I can understand, you know, some of the things that Shanahan might see in him. He protects the ball a lot better than Fields does. In my most recent mock draft, I have the 49ers taking Mac Jones. And what I've basically decided to base that off of is just, if you look at the people who are most connected in the league, like Schefter and Daniel Jeremiah, the NFL Network, they've got Mac Jones there. And when they talk about it, they've been really emphatic about saying they're confident in that pick. So, you know, even I don't have any source in San Francisco that says this, and I haven't spoken with anybody else who has heard it. But when the most connected guys in the league are saying that with such confidence, I'm inclined to believe them.
Yeah, I get that. I can talk myself into anything, though, this time of year. Like, Schefter, I mean, teams give Schefter the information. So, like, what you're saying to that point is, well, if anybody would know from the media, it might be Adam Schefter. But there's also a game that I think that gets played in the media where they don't want to give too much away. Like, I think if media guys like that knew what picks would be, they wouldn't necessarily tell you. there's a certain way of talking, right, Ryan? Like, well, you know, the different ways that they do it. So I don't think they would be necessarily, at least, dishonest about it. But I can always find sort of a reason to be skeptical.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, over the years, I've sort of figured out how to read between the lines on certain ones, because I've had sources with teams over the years who will tell me off the record, just point blank, who's number one on their board. And so then I'll put that into my mock draft, but of course I won't say, you know, I heard this from the team. I just sort of slide it in there quietly and play it off like I'm just guessing. So some of that absolutely happens in everybody's mock drafts. But when someone like Schefter comes out and says it so emphatically that he thinks that's the pick, I think we have to assume that, like, he's hearing that from a really good source. And, you know, he's kind of backtracked that in a couple days after he had that most emphatic statement about it about a week or so ago. But it's also really easy to just read that as they were like, hey, buddy, you know, ease off a little bit. Don't tell them who our pick is.
Yeah, that's what I mean. The way that Ian Rappaport tweeted about how the Eagles would have wanted to do this, but they knew Zach Wilson would be gone. And then he went back and he said, well, you know, I didn't exactly, whatever it was. You know, that was sort of, there was a backpedal right after that. So you're out there having sometimes teams tell you what they're going to do and you slide it in sort of carefully. Then it's up to guys like me to keep track of your mock drafts over the years so that I can try to figure out who your sources are, right? That's how it should work.
Exactly, yeah. And as someone who competes in some contests to try to have the most accurate mock draft, I have definitely tried to track that with some of the other people over the years. And yeah, there definitely are some trends that you'd notice if you did that.
I love it. Ryan McChrystal of NumberFire and Sharp Football Analysis here on WGR. I'm Mike Shope. So on Fields, do you think he deserves to be picked second?
If it were up to me, yes. But I think Fields and Wilson are so close that, you know, I don't really fault the Jets if that's the direction they're going to go. They have, you know, a lot of similar traits, a lot of similar flaws. It's really tough. Basically the deciding factor for me would be I've seen Fields do it against much, much better competition than I've seen Wilson do it. So I'm much more confident in him being able to come in and play capably immediately. Whereas with Wilson, like, yeah, he looked great tearing apart some bad competition this year. So I'm confident in saying I think he's going to be a really good quarterback. I would want him. But, you know, when you've got two prospects like that, sometimes, you know, using something like difference in level of competition can be a good tiebreaker.
Yes, it can. But, of course, you can also go wrong, right, just like with any of these things. Josh Allen is interesting to think about here. In fact, in terms of Trey Lance, there's a commercial running with Allen about ignoring the critics or the haters or whatever. Do you think Allen's success has real weight in terms of overall team evaluations about quarterbacks? Now, you're describing Wilson as like tearing up the competition he faced. Allen didn't exactly tear up the teams he played against at Wyoming, so it's different. But still, like, they did not. It was Wyoming, and now you're at a point where he's second in the MVP voting.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard to say. In the past, maybe 5 or 6 years ago even, I would say definitely teams would overreact because we always hear about how it's a copycat league, right? And so the Bills hit on their, like, crazy freak athlete, strong-arm quarterback and developed him into a superstar. Other teams would probably want to do that. But we're getting more and more teams that seem to be a little bit more cautious as to not try to go and find the outlier because, you know, Allen proved everybody wrong, obviously. He's a legit superstar now. But when the next guy comes along, I don't think we can say with any more confidence that he's going to be able to do that because, I mean, even with Josh Allen, let's imagine he went to the Jets and he goes and has to play under Adam Gase and under multiple offensive coordinators his first couple of years. Does he look like he did in Buffalo this year where he was in a good, stable situation mm-hmm. with good talent around him? My guess is no. So I would say hopefully teams don't try to find the next Allen, but seeing him have success should give teams who feel like they have a good, competent head coach, good GM, the ability to put talent around them, his success maybe gives them a little bit more confidence in their evaluation, saying, like, look, this has been done before. If we do it the right way, it'll work out.
It's also probably an easier sell to whatever extent that matters, right? Like, you can point to Allen. Teams can do that and say, hey, you can say all you want. Give us all the reasons that you want as to why this wasn't a good pick, but it can work. And he is recent and powerful proof of that. And in the case of Darnold, he starts with Todd Bowles as well. Like there was a coaching change there after year one, and it just never lined up there. So, Ryan, we've got, like, we know quarterbacks are going to be 1 and 2 and almost definitely 3. Who are your predictions for the teams to pick quarterbacks 4 and 5?
So in my mock draft right now, the next quarterback to have off the board is Fields to the Lions at number 7. And I don't have a ton of confidence in that because, you know, we kind of assumed when they got Goff that they wouldn't be going quarterback. But we also didn't think Justin Fields would be on the board. And so I suspect that they would consider it with him falling to them unexpectedly, whereas they probably just didn't think that was an option a couple weeks ago. And then the next one I have Trey Lance lasting all the way to 15 to the Patriots. I have him lasting that long partially just because with my mock drafts, I don't like to screw around and try to mm-hmm. predict trades. That's even harder than trying to predict the picks mm-hmm. in order. But I put him to the Patriots because I think it's possible he falls outside the top 10, maybe even all the way to 15. And then if he does fall outside the top 10, the Patriots would probably be a team who would consider going to get him.
Yeah, that makes sense, I think, too. And I think I respect what you said about Trey trying to predict these things because it's seemingly almost impossible to do that. But if New England is thinking this way, and I think a lot of us think they are, okay, so it gets to 8, 9. You get to Dallas there. I mean, there are ways to make small jumps to get to the quarterback at that point. It might not be possible to do what they want right now to lock that in, like what the Niners did. But as the draft starts to play out, you know, you just have to take the chance that the player makes it that far, of course.
Yeah, definitely. And especially with them being a fairly conservative organization with their draft picks, they're probably not going to try to go all the way up to number four. But, yeah, if he's on the board at, like, number eight, number nine, that could be where they start to make some phone calls and possibly pull the trigger on going up for either Fields or Lance.
So, Ryan, the Bills are at 30. And speaking of things that are tough to predict, it's hard to know exactly what they're looking at right now when the first 29 picks have been made. What do you like for them?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to figure out exactly what player they're going to get. I mean, I could probably give you 12 to 15 names of guys that are in a conversation for them. But I think they're in a great position to be one of the winners in this draft based on how their needs match up with what's likely to be on the board for them. Because I think we can probably narrow it down to an offensive lineman, a pass rusher, or a cornerback. Those seem to be some areas that they don't necessarily have to address, but could use some upgrades there or at least some depth. And then there's probably going to be at least three or four players at each of those positions who you could justify taking a late first-round pick on. So right now in my mock draft, I have them taking Gregory Rousseau, the pass rusher from Miami. And basically my logic there is that, you know, Hughes and Addison are getting up there in age. You can never have too many pass rushers to rotate in and out. So if, you know, a really productive player like Rousseau lasts until the late first round, it seems like a good fit for them to bring someone in who's going to probably contribute as a role player right away and then possibly as early as next year step into a bigger role.
And so you like Rousseau well enough to deserve first round status?
Yeah, I think in the late first round. I know some people are a little down on him because his testing numbers weren't that great at his pro day, but he was a player who opted out this year, so that could maybe be a little bit of an excuse because, you know, when you watch him on tape, he's clearly a great athlete, and he was absolutely dominant. And he's also young, which probably gives teams a little bit more confidence that, you know, once they get him into an NFL weight room and start training him, that he's going to start to show some of that athleticism again that they saw in the field early in his career.
I saw your tweet from an hour ago or so on the Browns and Jadeveon Clowney, and you wrote that the Browns might have wanted Clowney because testing numbers on other pass rushers, at least for Cleveland, in terms of that fit, was not ideal. So that doesn't – I mean, these things don't contradict each other. You think that, you know, quality-wise, it's good enough for the Bills.
Yeah, I mean, that was very specific to Cleveland because when you look at the pass rushers that they've added with Andrew Berry there, I think every single person, I haven't gone back to look up Clowney, so that maybe he breaks this trend, but to that point, every single person had 34-inch arms. And that's kind of a rare trait to have arms that are that long, so it just strikes me as something that's probably not a coincidence. And so that eliminates a bunch of guys. But the Bills, they don't seem to have, you know, a type necessarily. I mean, we just saw them draft A.J. Epinesa last year.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, he really doesn't check a lot of those boxes and didn't test really well, but he was really productive. So I could see them taking another player like Rousseau, who is a better athlete than Epinesa and also has that production. So if they're a team that just kind of like focuses on production, their scouts grades, I think Rousseau is probably in the mix for them still.
I'm just going to take a shot here that Ed Oliver qualifies in that way too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Are we guessing that Clowney has 34-inch arms, Joe? He was first overall. I'm gonna say yes on that.
Yeah.
I'm gonna guess that he probably had all the boxes checked. Clowney, what do you think, Ryan? You think it's likely?
I think it's likely. Yeah, and he's certainly long. So if it's not 34, it's probably 33 plus.
Close enough. We'll have to adjust the chart to 33. Hey, one more question I have, and it's back on quarterbacks. Today, Joe and I were talking earlier about how you're now seeing, at least for me, like maybe this has always been there, but I'm now noticing two or three more quarterback names in round two. I think it's interesting to think about what a team wants to accomplish with a quarterback in round two. Like they probably have somebody, maybe it's the Giants or some team like that, where they have somebody, but they're not sure, so they sort of middle it like that. Is there quality in those players that's deserving of a second-round pick? And so, like, what do you see happening?
It's hard to say. The teams that take quarterbacks on day two have all sorts of different motivations. A lot of times it's teams who are just desperate. So, like, with the Bears, let's say they don't get someone in round one and then they decide to take one in round two as sort of a way for Nagy and Pace to say to their owner, like, hey, you can't fire me yet. We just got our guy. Like, give us another few years. That definitely happens. And the other thing is sometimes you just have, like, very, very raw prospects with a lot of upside who teams just decide to roll the dice on. And this year that could be someone like Davis Mills from Stanford. He only started, I want to say, 9 games or something like that in college, but he was, among the top prospects physically. He looks the part. He's got the big arm, decent athlete. So, maybe he's the next quarterback off the board in the second round, and some team who probably already has a starter locked in says, we really like this guy's traits. We trust our coaching staff. Let's see if they can develop him over 2 years.
Would you say that's kind of what Philadelphia did last year?
Yeah, basically. That's the same kind of thing. It's like, here's a guy who's probably not ready, but let's bring him in and try to coach him up.
So you like, before you go, Ryan, you like Detroit for a quarterback. That's a really curious situation.
Yeah, it's tough. It's just a guess based on the fact that we all assumed they weren't going to take a quarterback, but we also thought their choices were going to be Trey Lance or Mac Jones. But if they're faced with Fields, who a lot of teams think is worthy of a top 5 pick, I could see them saying, let's bring him in and just have him and Goff compete right away. And, maybe he starts right away and we just, sit Goff on the bench and eat that contract for a couple of years.
Right. Well, like you said, we feel the same way. This is really fun. All the speculation is really fun. It's a little sad when it's over. Ryan McChrystal, our guest from NumberFire. Thank you, Ryan. Nice chatting with you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Ryan McChrystal. His name is his Twitter handle with the underline there after his first name. If the Lions draft Fields or any rookie and he starts, does Sal lose the golf points? Yes.
Oh, of course he does.
Opening day starter.
He gets one.
He gets one instead of 6.
I'm in for that.
That would flip the game. I'd win. Of course, if the Bears do it, I wouldn't win. The Bears draft a quarterback and that person starts over Andy Dalton, then I would get crushed because I have the Bears.
Who's more likely to be starting a rookie week one?
Detroit or Chicago?
Probably Chicago.
Chicago has to make a trade, but they could, and if they do it, they're the answer.
Yeah, right, because Detroit is much more likely to have a rookie and still have Goff playing.
To me, it shouldn't matter. I think it shouldn't matter. But wasn't there a statement about how Dalton say
he was told
he's been told
he was
yes.
told he's the starter.
Yeah,
like week one, like there's no competition. You don't got to worry about Nick Foles.
Nick Foles is still there.
He's still there. So yeah, he said he was told that he's the starter. I guess they could go back on that.
Right.
They could also say, oh, you're the starter for week one, but we didn't say anything about week two.
I just need him for week one. That's where you get your points in our game.
Yeah.
We will talk about the Jack Eichel news some when we return. 803-0550. It's been almost all draft so far since 3 o'clock. Give us a call if you'd like. Mike Schopen, the Bulldog, WGR.
Confident race every game. You see, we can turn around against Boston even. So after this game, we got more confident. And we're a young group of guys, and we learn every game. So I think after every game like this, we're a confident race for sure.
Well, it's now been, it's Rasmus Dahlin, 14 games for the Sabres under Don Granato. Jack Eichel did not play in any of them and will not play in any of them remaining. I think it's also 14, isn't it? They have left. It was announced today, probably heard by now, he will not be back this season. It seems like we're back to, this happened early in the season. I don't know if it's because it's warranted or because we're just always so desperate to get there, but like feeling like I'm only hearing about optimism, which, I'm not saying that that's a bad thing or anything. I just want to be right, Early in the season, the Sabres were okay, and I read that as a positive, progress, and we had lots of different conversations with Bulldog and with Paul all the time, like, hey, this is pretty good, right? This isn't terrible, so that's good, right? And then it got terrible, and so I just don't like the feeling. I don't like feeling like a sucker, just what was I falling for? I was falling for a team that wasn't terrible and trying to sort of talk myself into maybe it's pretty good. And it wasn't. And so what is this now? The Eichel injury means a lot. I mean, he's not there to give us a chance to measure it really honestly, like what this is going into the future. There'll be changes, of course, anyway, to the roster. They've played 14 games and they've won 4 under Granato. I like what I hear from him, and I think, A, it's right to watch their games and feel like it's an improvement. B, that's almost nothing to say, because what it was before was worse than should ever be acceptable in professional sports. So, okay, it's better, but what does that mean, actually? Joe, you are somebody that I'm thinking of as having sort of posted and kind of talked a little bit like, you know, it's not that bad looking forward. Now, I'm not talking about games anymore. I don't know what you feel about, how you feel about last night's game or any of these other games, but looking at the roster and thinking about what they might be next year, am I right here that you sort of feel okay?
I feel more optimistic than I did a month ago. It's hard to not feel more optimistic than you did a month ago.
So how come?
I think it's I've been calling it finding out stuff season. Like that's kind of what we're in now. It's not about the results, and there's young players that are actually playing under Don Granato. Mittelstadt looks good. Thompson looks improved. He still drives me crazy on a night-to-night basis, but he doesn't look useless like he did at the beginning of the season. Joki Haru looks a lot better. Dahlin looks like a completely different player than the beginning of the year. And Ruotsalainen looks good in a couple of games. Like, it's a lot of these disappointing young players that, especially at the start of this year and with Mittelstadt and Thompson going back to the last couple years, just some of them expectations were really low. And for them all to be playing pretty well at the same time, from my eyes, that has me thinking very positively about next season. And Reinhardt playing center has me a little intrigued about the future, because center is where I've been getting destroyed since Ryan O'Reilly left. Like, outside of Jack Eichel, their centers have been destroyed on the ice. And if I have Reinhardt playing this well at center, and Mittelstadt playing this well at center, and Cousins playing this well at center, and Eichel is still on the team, I've got 5 decent options down the middle.
So to varying degrees.
To varying degrees. So I think just the overall picture at center looking a lot better is maybe the biggest reason why I feel better about them right now.
Reinhardt not getting hardly ever a chance to play center before this is just another thing. It's near the top of the list for me. Like, it just never added up. You can't – how did they justify that? It just did not – also considering, like, if you have an organization that's humming, your investment in him long term is relevant to how you use him. And so where do you want to be? You want him to be as important as is possible. And so, I mean, at the risk of overdoing it, because sometimes that can happen with positions in hockey, you know, right? But still, like, give the guy the job. Give the guy the way the numbers on him have always been so positive. I just always felt like this happened so many different times, different reasons. It's always felt like the Sabres didn't care about the statistics, and they just kept losing and losing and losing, and, you know, just numbers be damned, we're doing it our way, and, like, just going nowhere forever. So maybe that's different now. This hire today, Karmanos, is probably a good sign in this way. I mean, if you're not running your sports team now largely by numbers, you're way behind. I don't think the Sabres got ahead with this move, but maybe they made up ground. They probably made up ground with this hire today, Karmanos from Pittsburgh. By the way, on him, so I just did a quick search earlier today. I want to see what I can learn about him. One thing that comes up is the Penguins bio, but you click on that, like, oops, it's gone because he doesn't work there anymore. On Wikipedia, you get his father. Peter Karmanos owned the Whalers, not their entire existence, but it's kind of interesting to read. You might already know all this. He owned the Whalers and then moved them to Carolina. And there are 3 sons. Jason Karmanos, who the Sabres hired today, is one of the sons. They sued him. I've got a story from 2016 where they sued him over another business, like their company, not a sports business. CompuWare, is it? So there was a lawsuit where the three sons, I guess the brothers, sued the father. I don't know how that ended, but it's something that comes up when you search the name. How about this paragraph? So Peter Karmanos, the dad, he is now a minority owner of the Hurricanes. They have a new, what's the new guy's name? Durden or Dundon?
Dundon? Yeah.
So they have a different majority owner, but he's still in there somewhere. Karmanos, his CompuWare partner, Taves, maybe is how it's pronounced, and former player Jim Rutherford purchased the Hartford Whalers in 1994. I didn't know Rutherford ever bought the Whalers. Purchased the Whalers for $47.5 million. At the time, they had committed to keeping the team in Hartford for at least 4 years. Connecticut's then-governor Lowell Weicker, who, by the way, like I know about him from Watergate. I'm a Watergate buff, and Weicker was on the committee with Sam Ervin and Howard Baker and Fred Thompson. Like Weicker, he had a prominent role in that. He was the governor of Connecticut. I just learned that today. Connecticut's then-governor Lowell Weicker announced that Karmanos would be critical for the team to stay in Hartford. Like the purchase, right? That this would be big for the team being able to survive in Hartford. Which it didn't. We know that it didn't. Weicker later became a member of the CompuWare board of directors. Huh. Anyway, Hartford sold fewer than 11,000 season tickets for the 95-96 season, and Karmanos announced the team would leave Hartford if the Whalers were unable to sell 11,000 season tickets the next year. Even though they surpassed 11,000, the team was moved anyway to Raleigh and renamed the Carolina Hurricanes. Yeah. So there's that story. But this is not the guy. This is the father. Jason Karmanos.
That guy is not now the associate GM of the Buffalo Sabres.
No, his son is. He has a good reputation in hockey, and the inside scoop in Pittsburgh was that he was more data driven than Rutherford wanted the Penguins to be as they operated, and in time they were both out. Like Rutherford was out too with Pittsburgh, but
beginning of the season.
Beginning of the season. Karmanos seemed to be doing good work.
Yep.
He won a Carolina in whatever his role – he won a cup in whatever his role was in Carolina and then was on the Penguins staff that won two more.
He was assistant GM in Carolina too, which would give him the connection to Kevin Adams. Mm-hmm. Rutherford, by the way, Greg Wyshynski last week with Bulldog floated that idea out there that, like – wonder if he becomes the president of hockey operations. And Karmanos worked under Rutherford for, many years in Pittsburgh. So I like the data-driven part of
this. But maybe obviously there was a disagreement. Like maybe they had a philosophical difference toward the end. I don't know, but I've heard that as speculation. In which case, it'd be weird if Rutherford came in. But I'm not telling you that I know how that's supposed to go. So I like this. This is good. I mean, the Sabres need some amount of this sort of reinforcement in the front office. I don't need all the scouts. Some people think they need all the scouts. Got to have the most scouts. Like they were winning when they had the the full complement. Right. Terry Pegula bought the team and wanted to rebuild the scouting staff and that department and everything. They didn't get better. By the way, the Rams, not to switch sports, but the Rams is a good story about how they just didn't bother with the Senior Bowl. Teams are just
really,
this is just like way ahead of your time. I've been saying this for many years. It's just all of it is so excessive, so redundant. All that scouting, just such a huge waste of money. But teams are just like, I don't know if they're afraid or they just somehow believe in it. And they're just out there doubling and tripling over each other's work, doing the same thing. Like the public information is so good that you really just don't need hardly any of it. But, you sit at a bar and somebody at the bar is going to tell you how the Sabres need scouts and you say, what do you just roll your eyes because they don't have the correlation.
Yeah, I've had the thought plenty of times this year that like I wonder how they would do if they just drafted from a book for the next 5 years. Like if they just went to Bob McKenzie's prospect rankings and just drafted off that for 5 years, how would it go? Would it go that much worse than it's gone the last 10 years?
You're just trying to flirt with me now. I've made this point for almost my entire career about the NFL. It's not, I wouldn't do, if this were ever to become a real thing, I wouldn't pick one analyst. But there are dozens of them now, and they overlap so frequently in their projections and their picks. I mean, I was writing on our website, I don't know, years ago, pretending that my daughter was drafting for the Bills and who they would have picked had she just, all I'm doing is taking like 20 different mock drafts or projection lists and like, okay, here's the seventh best guy, here's the eighth best guy. And you can do it blindfolded and come very close and do about as well as the real teams do. What does that tell you? I've always liked that point. And so, Joe, I don't know if you're trying to butter me up. Do I have a trade offer in my inbox? Is that what this is? You have made me a trade offer, and you're just trying to sort of get me to like you?
I got
to
work on it now.
A little bit. I feel like that's what's happening. Yes, totally. So good for the Sabres, and congrats to this guy. Hope it works out. The more numbers you're using to make your choices, the better off they'll be. It worked for the Bills. The Bills skyrocketed. Game situation type data skyrocketed to the top of the league. Good for them. A lot of other things went into it also. I'm not saying it was the only thing, but they did that, and they won. And the Sabres look like they've done almost none of it over the years with their decisions, and hopefully that changes because I think they've been pretty bad all of those seasons. Maybe it will. Hoping to have Paul Hamilton on as we continue here towards 7. Working on that. 803-0550 is the number here. Mike Schoep and the Bulldog. Chris is off today. Sneaky Joe along. This is WGR.
Yeah, it's tough. It's always tough missing time. No one wants to go through, you know, a stretch like this watching games. So just hope he recovers and comes back better for him.
Sam Reinhardt there. Jack Eichel will not be returning to the Sabres this season, the Sabres said in a tweet and maybe in a release that they expect him to be good to go next year. So what did we get? 2020-21. Eichel, 21 games, 2 goals. Wow. That's going to stand out. If he plays 12 more years and doesn't have another shortened season, even, I mean, 21 games, 2 goals could be 1 game for him. But 21 games, 2 goals. If he has a Hall of Fame career for the Sabres or whoever, people will look back on his career and be like, what happened? What was that? 3.3 shooting percentage, 2 goals, 16 assists, 18 points. So what happens? Well, it is a choice. That sort of the optimism we're talking about it. At least today, I can feel differently, but today I feel optimistic overall about him and them. I no idea though if what he's got in mind, what kind of pressure he might want to use for a change of scenery, but I'd like to think that that's unlikely and that we'll see him in a Sabre uniform come October. Goaltending will be really interesting there. I mean, goaltending for me is usually not my focus because there's so much randomness in the position around the league. Players that you think of as good are sometimes bad in goal and vice versa. It's just so much fluctuation. After all that, though, I mean, as much as I might want to think like that, the Sabres are really in kind of a jam, I think, or there's at least cause for concern. And that's added to with Ullmark last night getting hurt again. I mean, he has been injured several times. Joe's using the word again in his updates to describe Ullmark's injuries. And yes, by the way, I did start him. I benched Vasilevsky, who ended up not playing. You don't care, but I did. And then I just noticed on my phone, I was driving home, and he was taken from the game. So the injury's not the point. The point is, he has that, but you're talking about a raise probably in a market, a coveted position. Has he, 32 teams, has he earned enough respect to get a better contract from another team? Maybe. He's going to want to find out. That's how the news of the last few days has sounded. He's going to want to find out. And so what do the Sabres do about that? I mean, do they give him a contract, presuming that it will, like, work for him, to keep him away from free agency in advance of it so he doesn't go to the market? Like, that's going to be a big contract. And should they want to do that? And if they don't, what then? No easy answers on that one, I think. The player, if you care about it and would think of it as a factor, the durability piece, and then what else you can figure out. You don't have the kind of organization where you can just, oh, I've got 50 good players, so I can trade three of them for a good goalie. Like, you don't have that here. So they'll have to get smart.
The injury is a part of that for me. I mean, if he's going to miss 15 to 20 games every year with an injury, the way his career has gone so far, I'm going to need a much more reliable backup option than they've had with Carter Hutton and Jonas Johansson. It's just not gotten the job done in any way. So if Ullmark wants to make $5.5 million on his next contract, my biggest worry with giving him that isn't even paying that much to a goaltender. It's, okay, well, now I've got to go pay $3 million for another goalie because I can't trust you to play 55 games this season, and now I'm putting almost $9 million into that position, and that's the last place that I want to
be. That's right. So I think what I want to do is pay the $5 or $5.5 million to someone else that I can trust, that I have enough reason to trust. The position is what it is, and you can't be too confident really ever, with the exception of like one or two guys. But I think I want to do that and figure out my backup after that, which would mean all new, and I don't think that's so terrible. Like, I've got nothing against Ullmark, but I don't think it lines up great. We'll see. Paul Hamilton will join us after sports and talk more about the Eichel news and the Sabres, do some more NFL draft next hour as well. Mike Schoep here with Sneaky Joe. Bulldog is off today. This is WGR.